The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, and welcome everyone, especially if you're new. And I seem to have a little allergy or something today, so we'll see how it goes with my coughing. So, well, the talk topic is equanimity. We'll be equanimous with my cough. At the end of the talk last week, a number of people came up to me and had questions about the talk, and two of the people in particular wanted to know about equanimity. So I thought, well, maybe equanimity is a nice topic from following last week's subject. Equanimity is one of the prime Buddhist virtues or qualities. It's kind of almost like the crown jewel of Buddhism, equanimity. And it's kind of like an emotion or a virtue or a quality or state of mind that people can have. It's a practice. But it's fairly common, I think, for people when they hear the importance or the role of equanimity in Buddhism to have a little bit of hesitation, a little bit of what? Because of the association with equanimity with maybe indifference, somehow being aloof or being too neutral about what's going on and not really connected or involved with our life. And so I want to read a few quotes from the tradition about equanimity. And the first quotes perhaps could be interpreted as being somehow indifferent. And the second quotes to show the opposite of indifference, difference. The sense of connectedness and involvement with the world that can come with equanimity. So this is from the Dhammapada. As a solid mass of rock, actually I think it's probably better translated as a solid mountain. So maybe visualize a mountain, big, solid. As a solid mountain is not stirred by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise or blame. So no matter how someone praises you or blames you, your stability, your equanimity, your balance is not upset by that. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage is clear and undisturbed. So no matter what happens, there's a feeling of clarity and undisturbedness that continues no matter what goes on in the midst of our complicated life. Touched by happiness and then by suffering. Who isn't sometimes experiencing happiness and sometimes suffering? So touched by happiness and then by suffering, the sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. Such a person who, like the earth, is untroubled, who is well practiced, who is firm like a firm pillar, who is like a lake without mud, runs in circles no more. So in some ways they're nice images of solid and grounded and present like a mountain. It's there in full way. Maybe you've known someone who just felt like they're really there for you and present. And no matter what was going on around them, they were just there and equanimous. For me, one of the great examples of that kind of just equanimity in the middle of chaos and drama and tears and laughter and was my son's preschool teacher. It was quite something to watch him in the middle of the classroom, and just there in a very caring and compassionate way. But I think he'd seen enough drama in the classrooms to not be caught by it, not be pushed around by it. And deep and clear like a lake. So to have someone who's so clear that the clarity, you feel it. They don't get ruffled by things. They're just there. You might feel they're caring. But this kind of image can also suggest to people, again, indifference or being removed or not connected. So here's some discussion from the ancient texts about equanimity. Equanimity purifies loving-kindness. Isn't that nice? So loving-kindness is what's in the forefront, our kindness, our friendliness to the world, our goodwill. But equanimity purifies it, makes it pure, so it's not caught up in all kinds of other extra things we might be involved in, desire to be liked, for example, or wanting to get something by, you know, being kind. The manifestation of equanimity is the subsiding of attraction and repulsion. So, I know, maybe you have different associations with the word attraction than maybe the tradition means, but somehow attraction of clinging, kind of grasping onto the attraction and repulsion, some subsiding of that kind. And this is said right after talking about loving-kindness as well. So how can loving-kindness and equanimity free us from the kind of partiality that involves with kind of wanting so strongly the kind of attraction or repulsion from people? The perfection of equanimity should be considered as follows. When there is no equanimity, the offensive actions performed by beings cause agitation in my mind. So here, it's kind of, here we're talking about something more challenging. When people do something offensive to you or to other people around you, the function of equanimity is to keep you from getting agitated. It doesn't mean that you don't care. It means that you're not stirred up by it. It means, okay. And then it goes on, and when the mind is agitated, it is impossible to practice the conditions for being awake. So if you want to be awake in a situation, be free and awake and connected, it's hard to do that. You can't do that if the mind is agitated. So equanimity keeps the mind from being agitated. Here's an interesting one. Without equanimity, a person cannot offer up something, make a gift, without making false discriminations over gifts and recipients. So the ability to offer a gift, which, you know, means you're connected, equanimity means perhaps, I don't know what they mean exactly, but I would suggest, it means you give a gift without a concern of liking or not liking or praise or blame, or you're not looking for something, you're not trying to build up your identity or anything. It's just you're there, and how it's received doesn't ruffle you. You're just there and you offer it freely without that kind of... So it's kind of, they consider in the tradition, kind of a purer way of giving. Without equanimity, one cannot purify one's virtue without thinking about the obstacles to one's lives and one's vital needs. I think what this means is that if you really want to practice virtue, if you get caught up in the difficulties of your life, the challenges you have, or you get caught up in what your, here it says vital needs, your survival things, there's a way of getting caught up in that that becomes agitating, or caught up in that, then it makes you imbalanced and keeps you from being equanimous and clear and balanced as you go through whatever you need to go through. So even in the midst of challenges, the hope is that you can stay, have some kind of equanimity. Equanimity is accompanied by compassion, and compassion by equanimity. So here also we see that equanimity doesn't stand alone, again, as an aloof, indifferent kind of way, but not only does it tie it to loving-kindness, but it also ties it closely to compassion. And then it goes on. How can a compassionate person look upon living beings with equanimity? Some teachers say, sometimes the compassionate ones show equanimity towards living beings when it is necessary to do so. But others say they do not show equanimity towards living beings as such, but towards the offensive actions performed by beings. Isn't that nice? So if we're equanimous about what people do, then it's possible maybe to maintain a compassionate connection to them. Now, being equanimous doesn't mean condoning it or accepting it in some naive way. It means that it has nothing to do with how we choose to relate to the things in the world. We might say no, we might say that can't happen, we might say we have to talk about this, we might leave the situation if it's dangerous or something. So all kinds of things we might do, but we do those things with a heart or a mind which is equanimous, which is balanced, which doesn't get ruffled or agitated by what's going on. The tradition talks about two kinds of equanimity. Actually, it talks about many. It's such an important topic in Buddhism that there's lists and lists of equanimity and kinds of equanimity. It's kind of like they say, and the Eskimos have many words for snow. Well, the Buddhists have many words for equanimity. But there's two primary ones. One is the word upekkha, and upekkha has the meaning. It comes from the kind of the word to see, to look, and it has the kind of the meaning of the equanimity that comes from having perspective, having an overview of the situation. So the preschool teacher, he had an overview of perspective. He was a tall guy, and these little kids were small. But he'd been there for a long time. He knew all the dramas that could happen. And so he had a perspective that things didn't get, he was staying balanced. I remember once I went into the preschool class, middle of the day for some reason. I don't know what the occasion was. And it was obvious to me that when we went into the class, when I went in, they were all very calm and quiet, the kids. Now, quiet, calm preschool class is one of the great pleasures in life. When I walked into the classroom, I was a disruption to the classroom, and suddenly all the kids were excited and running around like crazy, and I turned to the teacher and said, I'm sorry. And he said, no worry. It's all just a learning moment. It's all a learning opportunity. So that was his equanimity. He had an overview. He could handle it. He could see it. So there's a certain kind of equanimity that comes from having perspective and overview. A hospice nurse will tell sometimes family that as people die, it's not uncommon for a certain late stage of dying that they'll get angry to the people that they love the most, uncharacteristically so. And it probably has to do with chemical, physiological changes going on in the brain. And it's very helpful to have the hospice people say that, because then it's not taken so personally. You have the perspective, you have an overview, and you say, oh, okay, it's happening. I was told this would happen, and it seems to be a common enough pattern that I don't have to kind of take it so seriously that this means that a lifetime of relationship with this person is now being summed up in these harsh statements. It's just, just something different going on now. So to have some overview, some perspective, so the balance that comes from that, not getting caught up in something. The other form of equanimity is, the word is, it's a long word, tatramatta, I don't remember anymore. That's very long. But it sounds like a long, complicated word, but it's three little, very common words strung together, put together to a compound word. It means in the middle of things, being in the middle. So it kind of means a balance, to be balanced in the middle of things. And how I understand this is that as opposed to an understanding, a perspective that gives us balance or perspective, equanimity, this is when we have some kind of inner strength that keeps us balanced, so that if you have a certain kind of physical strength, then you're not pushed around by things so easily. And so if you have spiritual strength or psychological strength in certain areas, then you're less likely to be pushed around. So if you have strength and patience, then you come into a trying situation, and that strength keeps you balanced, keeps you from getting unbalanced. If you have concentration or a capacity to stay calm or to breathe deeply in difficult situations, that might keep you more balanced, less caught up and stirred up by what's going on. And so it's possible to cultivate and develop psychological, spiritual, strengths, that so that you walk into different situations, you're ready to stay balanced in the middle of it. So this points to the idea that preparing oneself. One of the things I said last week, the little cliche that I think it's worth remembering, is it's too late to dig a well for water once the house is on fire. So the idea, you know, it's good to prepare yourself, and that's one of the reasons why we have the practice, to prepare. And just the meditation practice itself, mindfulness practice, concentration practices, are all ways of preparing or building these strengths so we're prepared for whatever happens in our lives. So these two areas, having a wise understanding, a perspective, and having cultivated and developed ourselves inside. It's important to think, to realize it's both. Some people rely much too much on their cognitive understanding to try to understand the situation in order to find a balance or solution. And some people don't rely on it enough. And you know, these two go hand in hand. We want to develop ourselves, cultivate ourselves, some inner strength, and we want to develop ability to see and understand ourselves. So what I'd like to offer is the seven principles or seven conditions that support equanimity. And I like this a lot, this kind of teaching, because some of these virtues that Buddhism emphasizes are better not cultivated, sometimes are difficult to cultivate directly. So, you know, someone tells you, be equanimous. And, well, how do I be equanimous? But sometimes what we do is we put in place the conditions that support us to be equanimous. And so these are conditions that can support it. So the first is virtue, or I like the word integrity. The greater personal integrity we have, the less we have reason to be ashamed, less reason to be worried about what people are going to think about us, to be criticized. The Buddhist tradition talks about being able to go into any assembly blamelessly, the bliss of blamelessness. And so, even if sometimes you've done something that caused or hurt someone or offend someone, to take refuge in your intention. My intention was not to harm. My intention was to benefit. And knowing your intention is good can be a refuge. It keeps you balanced. Then you can maybe talk about what was going on and explore it. So there's a certain kind of balance or equanimity that can come from, you know, taking refuge or knowing your own integrity or virtue. The second is faith, trust or faith. When people have faith in something, it usually means that they're not worried about what's going to happen. They rely on something. And sometimes it can be certainly blind faith, and sometimes it can be not so blind faith. But what do you trust in? What do you have faith in that supports you? So, for example, I have a lot of faith in the practice of mindfulness. And I've learned over many years that when I am mindful of a situation, when I offer my presence, my non-reactive presence, to really investigate and be present to see what's going on, that generally things begin to work out. And so having that faith supports me in situations where I don't know what to do here, it seems very challenging and difficult, and something has to happen, and, you know, and rather than getting all kind of tight and tense and worried about, like, figure out what goes on, I've learned that I can trust the mindfulness. And so I fall back on the practice and enter into the situation with mindfulness. The other people have faith in, they have faith in themselves. I have faith that I can find a way through this difficulty. And having that faith, because you've gone through it many times, that confidence supports the equanimity. Confidence is only gained through experience, and so we do certain things over and over again, and we find out, well, I can do this. And so we enter into the situation with more equanimity. The next one is a concentration. The equanimity that comes, kind of like what I talked about earlier, of developing yourself. So concentration in Buddhism is very closely, almost synonymous with being calm. The capacity to stay calm, or maybe better, because some people don't like calm people so too much. It's, you know, like a little bit negative, like calm, you know, unruffled. to be unruffled by circumstances. And part of the function of concentration practice is to help us be unruffled so we can enter into situations with a balance. And I know people do that. I know it's fairly common for people here in Silicon Valley to come and ask me or talk about how the nervousness they have about giving a public talk or a talk for people in their place of work. And so people will prepare themselves for that. And the most common way is to go meditate, at least in our circles. Breathe deeply, just breathe for a while, in order to cultivate some modicum of calm. So you go into the talk with that calmness kind of, you know, close at hand. So concentration, calm, is a part of a class of different mental qualities that can be strengthened. Patience, mindfulness itself, to develop the mindfulness. So the mindfulness is a refuge and a support. So this has to do with, you know, a lot to do with cultivating and developing ourselves, these inner qualities. The third quality, which is kind of the emphasis I gave last week's talk, is investigation. And to have confidence in the value of looking more carefully, looking again. As some of you know, I'm very fond of the English word respect, because respect literally means in Latin to look again. Like spectacle, like the glasses, to inspect, and re is again, right, to look again. And somehow the idea of the respect is tied to giving someone a second look. Like someone's there, and you respect them, and you're going to kind of give them look at them more carefully, or kind of consider them more deeply. Don't just take the first impression. Let me just take this person in more fully as a person. But so investigation and respect, investigation and mindfulness and respect are all kind of, to me, is all nice together. So to investigate what's really going on here, and one of the really useful things to investigate is our reactivity. So in the situation I'm in, how am I reacting? How am I getting agitated? How am I getting ruffled by the situation? What are my concerns? What are my worries? What are my aversions? What am I believing in this situation? And spend some really quality time looking at that. Because as we understand our reactivity better, then we're going to be less pushed around by the reactivity, less caught by it. You might still be reactive, but it's a wonderful thing that can happen where you can feel yourself being reactive, and another part of you can observe it well enough and not identify with it. If we identify with the reactivity, since we are the reactivity, then there's no options, right, except being reactive. But if you can step back and kind of have an overview of yourself, a big, you know, bird's eye picture of your experience, and you see that you're getting angry, but that part of you that's watching is not the angry one. Who you are is the watcher more than the anger. Then the anger can kind of just be there, and you can kind of not be pushed around by it, not be caught by it so much, and chances are there'll be more equanimity, more balance. You won't be so ruffled. So to investigate, to have a dedication to investigate. The next is to have insight. Part of the function of mindfulness, concentration, investigation is to begin to have insight into our experience. And insight is to begin to see more deeply what's actually going on. To see the movements of clinging and aversion as they go on. To see that it's not necessary, have insight into the fact that it's not necessary to buy into a movement of clinging, buy into a movement of aversion. It's not necessary to buy into a thought. We have insight that a thought is just a thought, as opposed to a thought is the authority voice, the voice of authority that says this is how things are. It's a thought, and then we can investigate the thought to see whether it's wise or not. To have insight into the impersonal quality of some of these emotions and feelings and thoughts that arise, and to see these are just thoughts, I don't have to identify with them or take them personally. So one of the primary forms of insight, which means a seeing as opposed to an understanding, is to see clearly that the phenomena of our mind and heart and body doesn't have to be taken personally. Of course it's yours, but the identification with it, the locking into it and using it to define this is who I am and this has authority, is part of the, freeing us from that is part of the function of insight. And then from insight and from other life experiences, the sixth quality that supports equanimity is wisdom. Wisdom is more an understanding of how things work. And so we understand that someone is dying might get angry. We understand that when a mother understands when the three-year-old boy comes and says in 1 minute, "I hate you," and 3 minutes later comes back and says, "I want to marry you." You know, there's a certain equanimity, as opposed to "I hate you. Oh, this is the end of our relationship," and I don't know if we'll ever recover. that's what kids do, right? And so it swings. And you don't say, "I can't marry you. I'm already married to your father." Okay. So a certain understanding. So wisdom is important. And so how do you cultivate wisdom? A lot of wisdom is cultivated from experience. And how do you have experience? By having bad experiences. So whenever you have a bad experience, you can kind of be a little bit more willing than you normally are to experience it, because that's how hopefully you're going to become wise. So I say, here it's an opportunity. So then, and the last way, the last condition for equanimity is freedom, is to be free, to have a certain degree of spiritual or psychological freedom. So that, say that you're free from being locked in to being the perfect preschool teacher in everybody's eyes. You want praise for being a preschool teacher. And the parent comes to pick up the kid, and the kid is crying. Kids in preschool cry from time to time. And it's not in the control of the preschool teacher when. So they're crying when the parent comes and picks up. But the preschool teacher is free of needing, knows the whole scene, knows how it works, even knows how parents work. their sense of identity, their sense of praise and blame is not tied to the situation of the moment. There's a freedom there. In that freedom, their buttons are not pushed. They're equanimous. So to become free from attachments of a variety of different kinds. Because the more attached we are, the more we cling to things, the easier it is to get ruffled. The less attached we are, the less the mind is agitated. In fact, there's a beautiful passage that repeats in the ancient teachings of the Buddha. He says, when the mind clings, the mind is agitated. When the mind does not cling, it is no longer agitated. When the mind is not agitated, it becomes free. So be very careful for the ways in which you maybe have been protesting to what I've said today. Wait a minute. There are situations, wait a minute. Yes, but... it's okay to be agitated sometimes. Gil doesn't understand about those situations. Because if you're agitated, then you can't see clearly. You can't see yourself clearly, you can't see the situation around you clearly. And if you want to offer your loving kindness and your compassion in the most effective way, you want to be able to see yourself clearly and see the world around you clearly. And equanimity is part of that support. So, now you'll find out whether I'm equanimous enough as you ask questions or protest. So we have some minutes for questions if any of you would like to ask. Yes.
So I'm curious about the relationship between equanimity and compassion. So you talked about feelings come up and holding them like having the separate part that's sort of the observer, but I've also heard of having the separate part that's more nurturing.
Yeah, so the connection between compassion and equanimity I think it's helpful to think that there are different kinds of compassion and different circumstances. Compassion takes a different shape or takes a different way. It depends on the situation, the particular psychological behavior, I guess, mental behavior that represents equanimity. When it's connected to compassion, it's part of the Brahmaviharas. And the Brahmaviharas are the four social emotions that are championed in Buddhism: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. And here, when compassion, I think here the kind of equanimity was talked about is the Brahmavihara equanimity. So it's a way of relating to people that I call it grandmotherly love. Or maybe today's talk you call it preschool teacher love. You know, that a preschool teacher or grandmother is kind of a good example, right? Because a grandmother or a grandparent has already been through the drama of kids. And so they've seen it all. And so they can care very much for the grandchildren, but they're not caught up in the drama that the first-time parents are. So they love the kid, but there's this beautiful equanimity. So there's love and equanimity together, functioning together. And we want grandparents like that, whose compassion or love is connected to equanimity, and their equanimity is connected to compassion. So I don't know if that answers your question well enough, but that was my best effort. Is it okay? No?
I was thinking that there might be a path through compassion to equanimity.
Oh, yeah, I would think there is. I think there is, especially if you stay mindful. If you cultivate compassion but stay mindful as you do it, then you'll start kind of softening the edges, the rough edges, the sharp edges to the compassion, the areas with some clinging and holding. And so as you do that, then it becomes more equanimous. Yes.
I must say that the image that came to mind when you started this description of equanimity was someone called Data on the program Star Trek, and someone perfectly equanimous because there was no emotion there. And I began to feel a certain aversion to your talk because, you know, I had an accident happened to me a couple of days ago, and I was completely ruffled. And even though I understood the causes and what's going on, it nevertheless, I tried to step back, but it just didn't happen under the conditions that you described. So I began to feel that it was really not possible to achieve this goal that you were describing, which is such perfection. And it sounded too impossible.
So have you ever had an experience in your life in a less challenging situation of having some equanimity?
Yeah, occasionally.
Yeah, can you give an example?
Oh, an altercation with a close one, perhaps.
So it has happened for you. So it is possible.
But not to the complete degree that you were describing.
Ah, so I think there's a spectrum of our capacity to be equanimous in different situations. And what we're talking about in practice is not perfection. What we're talking about is beginning to shifting that spectrum so we can be wisely more equanimous more often. So there's more opportunities, more chances for it. So we're going to shift us towards being more equanimous. And maybe in the large crises, we're not going to be equanimous. But because we cultivated it and developed it, maybe in the medium crises, we're now equanimous. Whereas before, we were only equanimous at the absolute minor challenges, right? So we're kind of moving in that direction. And depending how much practice you do and how practice unfolds, you might be able to move that further and further towards the extreme. But I don't think you need to be worried about doing it in the extreme. It's just good to be going in that direction, to cultivate and developing us, because you might need it. It might be useful. And part of one of the wonderful things about equanimity, perhaps, is that the mind is capable of functioning different levels at the same time. So in a crisis where you are ruffled and not equanimous, maybe you can be equanimous about that. As opposed to, I'm really upset here and I'm furious and difficult, and then we add on top of that, we add, and I'm a horrible person because of that. So we add kind of layers and layers, and that's often happens. We kind of spin out with more and more reactivity. And so, it's bad enough. And then we say, okay, this is how it is. I'm spinning out, and I'll just accept that right now or be equanimous about that. I can't handle this situation. I'm just going to be equanimous about the fact that I can't handle this. Does that make some sense? So don't give up because don't give up because of extreme situations. Someone else has a mic? Who has the mic now? Yes,
thank you.
Well, what I found recently was that when someone did something that hurt me, quote, hurt me and offended me, that little ego, and disturbed by equanimity, so I went through a whole cycle of justification, analysis, all sorts of things. But finally, what I realized was that because what happened hurt me so much, I should not pass that on to anybody else. And when I think about going to say something or do something that might potentially hurt someone, just think, wow, how did I feel when that happened to me? And I don't want to do that to somebody else. And that brought me to equanimity.
Beautiful. That's a great teaching there. Something similar to that help some people to get to equanimity is the realization that as much as your enemy might be trying to harm you, the greatest harm is not from your enemy, but how you react to your enemy. So, for example, if you get furious, it maybe feels justified that you're angry, but only you can make yourself furious. Your enemy can only create the conditions for it. But actually the inner movement that goes on. And so I know some people who've said, I'm not going to do my enemy a favor by reacting to this. Thank you. So now, over here.
So this is also a comment. Is this working? Okay. That I find that I'm least equanimous when I'm afraid. And so, for instance, I was at work the other day and someone came in and observed my group and I started getting afraid of them observing it and thinking bad things about me. So I think what I need to do, what it involves for me would be kind of more of the trust aspect or more of the kind of leap of faith that I'd be okay, and maybe just watching the fear and having that cut. Watch that I am actually afraid instead of getting caught up in what I'm afraid of.
Great, that sounds great. And it sounds great maybe to do a kind of preliminary trust and then practice with it and see then if it's confirmed, if the trust becomes confirmed. So that was great what you said, that you said at the beginning that the primary place you lose equanimity is when you're afraid,
yeah.
Something like that. So that's a great investigation, to realize where it is you lose your equanimity, your balance. And to be able to look at that with kindness, with wisdom, with acceptance, without being upset by that, that's where that's the door to towards wisdom and greater understanding. So, sometimes in Buddhism or oftentimes, the way to use these ideals, and the talk today was talking about the ideal of equanimity. One of the useful ways of using this is not as something that you have to now suddenly try to be equanimous and live up to some ideal and be perfect in it, but to use the ideal as a mirror to help you understand what gets in the way of the ideal? What's your challenge around being equanimous? And then you can kind of look at that and understand it more deeply, what the challenge is, what the obstacle is, so fear, for example, or something, and then that might sometime fall away. And when it falls away, then you're available to respond to the situation more appropriately, and the appropriate response might not be equanimity. So if you're trying to live up to an ideal, you might kind of be living something which is not quite appropriate. It's like compassion. Situation might not call for compassion, but it always calls for working through the hindrances to compassion. And once those hindrances are fallen away, then we're available to respond with what's appropriate. And maybe it's compassion, maybe it's not, depending. So hopefully that makes sense. So it's very important. I think it's very important not to hold these ideals up as ideals of perfection that we have to now live up to, but rather use them as kind of like as a guiding star that helps us, or a mirror that helps us to see ourselves, understand ourselves better, so that we can kind of work through the challenges we have and find our balance that way. So it's time, and I would encourage you, especially those of you who didn't like this talk, I'd encourage you this week to make equanimity a subject of exploration. Talk to friends about equanimity. Explore what it means. You know, walk up to total strangers and say, how do you understand equanimity? Talk to your friends. Kind of explore the topic. Kind of make it rich for the week for you. And then look for opportunities during the week for situations where you can clearly identify, I was equanimous there. You identified as equanimity. What was that like? And then look for opportunities, hopefully not too many, where you're not equanimous. You lost your equanimity. And then get curious about that and look at that and kind of make it a topic. Maybe you write, a big sticky note across your bathroom mirror, equanimity. Something to remind you during the day. I think it's really a great thing. And I know it's a little bit hard for maybe people who haven't done a lot of meditation, but in deep meditation in particular, the experience of pure equanimity is one of the most sublime and beautiful experiences you can have, short of liberation itself. So it's well worth exploring. Thank you.